Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Wednesday, May 4th, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free on the internet, on the website at whyagain.org. And through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice, you can go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, and it'll take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for almost 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself, a simple PDF file, no requirement for payment, no requirement to get put on a mailing list. Simply click the link, download the file, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over and over again. Which is pretty amazing when you consider the power and the value of that tool and how often and how long Michael and Jeannie Rice have been donating their time, intelligence, money, and energy to making it available to as many people as possible absolutely free. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one where people have been stepped through that worksheet process. And listening to those can serve as a tutorial, so teach you how to use that tool to great effect in your own life. You can also choose to go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And if you choose to click on the link that shows up, it's the glowing heart icon that will show up probably before you're done typing the word forgiveness. It will allow you to get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. And we hope people do that soon and often because it frequently leads them to have answers, comments, questions, testimonials. And if you happen to be someone who's done any of that or has a question or a comment or an answer or a testimonial, you can call us at 563-999-3581. When you call that number and press 1 on your phone, it will put a little icon of a hand by your phone number. And when I see that, I will turn on your microphone and announce you by your area code. Alternatively, you can send us an email. If you're listening to this in the archives, you can email at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org. Or you can email Jeannie at J-E-A-N-I-E at whyagain.org. Whyagain.org. And again, we greatly appreciate it when people do that for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is that it makes it easier for us to live into our intention with this work. The intention with this work is to be of service. The intention with this work is to share with people some of these powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools that we have been using to improve the quality of our life and relationships. And we understand that the more we share that with others and they actually choose to use them, the better their lives get, the better the world is for that experience. We had our support group last night and we listened to another Guy Finley talk and then had some discussion. It is, it continues. The support groups frequently pick up on a theme that's been happening in the internet show and take it a little deeper or give people a chance to question it for clarification. And that's what we were doing last night. The themes just keep challenging the Western mind. That's, the biggest thing about it is that the Western mind has been so thoroughly conditioned to elevate the intellectual mind to the level of master and or deity. And, that Way of Mastery even points that out and says, you've basically been trained to turn your intellect into your God. And that's contraindicated here. That's the right there in the first lesson in the Way of Mastery. It says, this pathway that we're trying to introduce you to, the way of the heart, is not the way of the intellect. It's not something you can think your way into and through. And we were talking about that last night. Some questions were coming up. But then what do I do and how do I do? And that's what the Western mind can't really wrap itself around, is that there isn't really a how to do this that provides the kind of step-by-step logic that the Western mind is looking for. That very process of trying to figure it out is what keeps me out of the space of the awakened heart. It keeps me out of the opening questioning, the gentle, childlike, soft, open, allowing questioning space. And so then what do I do? Right? That's what the conscious logical mind is completely trained to think. It is going to drive the bus. Just tell it what to do and it will do it. I want to be enlightened. So tell me what I should do next to be enlightened. And the answer is, what you should do, Mr. Conscious Logical Mind, is just go over here at the kiddie table with some Oreo cookies and milk and just get distracted. Because there's nothing for the conscious logical mind to do except to wake up to the fact that the more it tries to do, the more it screws everything up. This is the essence behind mindfulness and meditation. It's a practice that when we are willing to engage the practice, it lets us experience what happens at different levels of consciousness when the conscious logical mind is not being given all the power, is not being asked constantly for what to do next. There is this potential to step into a level of experience that's not driven by my logical thought process. And yet, the longer I focus so heavily on what my five senses are telling me and what my thought pattern and my analytical mind is telling me, the longer I stay distracted from the very real, the very powerful essence of an entirely different level of intelligence that will be there for me, that will teach me if I just ask to be taught, if I just open myself to its experience, to its impression, to its insight or intuition. And it's one of the things that Guy Finley was saying in the beginning of his talk last night is that, you know, we won't see this because we won't look at it. We won't stop and slow down. And we won't let ourselves see the parts of our mind that need to be seen through, that need to be seen as false, that need to be released. We will continue to pour our mind energy into valuing thought processes which just keep creating hurt, sadness, bitterness, anger, frustration, confusion, etc., because we think that's the way to end our pain. Let me think my way out of this prison of thoughts. It's not going to work. So the Way of Mastery, as we've been working with it since January 10th, and the first book in the Way of Mastery, titled The Way of the Heart, is an introduction to the possibility that we might learn through an entirely different process than figuring it out logically. We might be ushered into a set of experiences that can teach us about ourselves and our relationship to the world in a completely different way than we've ever been introduced to before. But to do that, we have to release our attachment to the old ways. We have to start questioning with our intellect how useful it is to keep doing the same thing over and over again and getting the same results that we don't like. You know, at one point in the Way of Mastery, it says, the intellect is only useful to help you see how useless the intellect is, how limited it is. And, you know, it's almost like the idea of the only really usefulness in questioning is not finding answers, but in learning to stay in the open space of questioning. So rather than being a Sherlock Holmes, what we're called upon to do in this work is be the childlike, innocent questioner in every moment, not using all of these little details to come up with answers so we can say, aha, we were right and so-and-so was wrong, but to be actively engaged in the questioning, in the awe space, stepping into questioning and awe, stepping into the realization that the more we learn, the more we realize how little we know and how we will never understand all of creation and the expansion of life. And at the same time, we won't understand it in a way that we can, you know, grind it down to just a few little bits that our conscious logical mind can understand. We can step into an experience of it that goes beyond the bounds of time and space. So, area code 541, you're in the air.
Celinda here.
Is this Celinda?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me all right?
Yes. You're a little bit soft, but I can hear you.
Let me turn my volume up. Is that better?
We'll make it work. How can we serve you? What's up?
Well, when you were sharing about the mind, all of a sudden I got in my mind, and I don't know quite how to language it yet, so I'm going to stumble along a little bit here because it's connected to a whole bunch of other learning. Basically, what I've been very resistant to technology, and I wasn't quite clear why. And I think that you have actually filled in the missing piece for me, or connected the missing dot, so that I can, at this moment in time, have a new revelation about the mind. And what I realized is that the mind is only a download device, the conscious mind. It's the algorithmic, or whatever they call it, part of the brain that we have been given or created for ourselves, whichever, and that its function is to be the simple servant. I prefer simple to stupid because I do not think of ignorant as stupid. It's just ignorant, and simple is simple. And so it's the simple student. It has one job to do, and that's to be the program for the programmer and to accept whatever programs the programmer puts into it. And it seems to me that when we decided to go our own way and eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which is a tree of death, that mind, it seems like in the Course in Miracles it mentioned something about we that was an attack on God, and so what we did was we created a substitute, or as Michael would say, a cheap copy of how our Christ minds were supposed to work for us. And that what happened is we made ourselves the master instead of the servant, and that altered the whole picture. And it reminds me of Tolkien. In the 50s, Tolkien, after he'd written The Lord of Rings, was talking, or before, whichever, I'm not sure, was talking about his concerns about technology becoming the next empire. And I read it in some alternative magazine somewhere, and they were quoting him where he was talking about that. And pretty soon we'd all be bowing down to technology. And I realized what my resistance was, because what we've done is we've created this conscious mind, or whoever created it for us to survive in this physical world. And maybe we did it because we traded thrival for survival. But what happened was that we began to worship at the altar of the conscious brain, which was a very simple student, servant. And then I ran across an indigenous prophecy. I think it might have been Hopi, where they talked about somewhere there's, it's a petroglyph, I believe, on a cliff or canyon wall, and it's something about they show these figures, and they show figures that at some point the people in these little stick figures change. And the simple little stick figure keeps going along horizontally, and the other figure starts going up, 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 up. And it's kind of representative of like technology, but I don't remember how it was depicted. And pretty soon what happens is there is such a division, and there's connecting points between the two paths. But at some point, there is no connecting point anymore. And that figure that kind of like a space helmet on or whatever it was. And he, she ended up disappearing in a thunderbolt. And the little horizontal path ended up in a little cornfield with a little old gardener. And I thought that was so significant. And I was thinking, I'm thinking about all these. I was listening to, I was watching a video, YouTube video, about the pineal gland. And the people, the man who was describing it made this, whatever a pyramid is, I forget what you call it. And it, he said, oh, and now we see how this works with the pineal gland and this and this and this, and makes this perfect pyramid. And now we can create a machine to do the same thing. And I'm going, ah, we have it inside of us already. And we're out there worshiping this program device, like our computers. What's the proper use of our computers? When it's programmed properly, it can be very beneficial. And when it's just worshipped and valued, as it says in the Way of Mastery, what do we value? Then it becomes a, kind of like a perversion or a cheap copy anyway. And we give up our power, we give up our freedom, we give up our uniqueness, all of that for a program, and it can be the program of our own mind. So I don't know if that makes any sense at all, but it, for me, it was a great aha. We were created with a complete brain, but we have given up the brain that is connected, the hemisphere that is connected to our creator, the intuitive brain. And we have denied it and disrespected it, and because we're supposed to have a whole brain, we're in trouble. We're not in trouble, but I mean that's our journey home, to bring those two together in their rightful association.
Okay. Well, it sounds like a lot of words to talk about, essentially a slightly different aspect of what we're driving at with the Way of Mastery, and how it's telling us from the first lesson on that the intellect is very, very useful in its place, but it is not supposed to be driving the bus.
Exactly. And I live in a tree with many branches, so I tend to bring in branches that other people don't need, but they all make sense to me.
All right. Well, is there a question in what you're doing, or just presenting what you, the realization you had?
Just presenting the realization and hoping to spring forward from that aha to many more new ones that are transformative for my living experience.
Okay. Well, I wish you well with that. I will mute you so you can listen, and we'll keep reading. And if you've got another comment, feel free to press the one on your phone twice so it'll take the hand down and then put it back up.
Thank you.
All right. Blessings. So lots of different cultures have known some of this from slightly different perspectives, lots of different teachings. And Dr. Michael Rice says, you know, to get this message, you've got to be out of your mind. You've got to drop the conscious logical mind. You've got to understand that there is, as Guy Finley would talk about, something that's a higher level of integration. And you can get access to its input if you just will give up the idea of needing to be right. And as this lesson will ask us to do in just the next page or two, get really clear about what we're giving value to in our lives, right? What are we giving top priority to? So in lesson 9, it's talking about the title being All Events Are Neutral. And it's talking about in various ways these kinds of paradoxes, these kinds of contradictory statements like, in reality, all dimensions of creation reside in the space far smaller than the tip of a pin. At the same time, in reality, all dimensions of space and creation are so vast that you could never measure them. Well, the conscious logical mind says, that's ridiculous. This is gobbledygook. This is doublespeak. This has no value. And yet, that's what a lot of these spiritual traditions do. They create a parable, a paradox, a koan, a contradictory statement, a bind, a trap for the conscious logical mind so that it can spin, you know, wearing itself out, trying to make sense of this at a conscious logical level, and then it finally gets tired, it beats itself up, and then it just takes a nap, and then something else can come forward. Something else can spring into your awareness, bubble up from deep inside of you, or the fog clears and you can see what was always there. It also, in this lesson, wants us to understand that your physical body, your brain, your voice, is simply a very temporary communication device. And that all events are neutral until you choose a value for it and then start labeling it that way and then start communicating about it. And so, when we realize that the purpose of your body is to serve as a communication device for you, and everything that you choose to think and say and do is broadcasting out to the people around you and the world around you what you value and what you think is important, then the question becomes, what do I choose to communicate to the world? With every gesture, with every breath, with every word spoken, with every decision made, what am I choosing to communicate to the world? And I think I ended last session yesterday with talking about how Guy Finley wants us to know that if you want to know what you value, look at your life. And no matter how much somebody has a life where they are complaining about everything in their life, that's what they value. They value the complaining. They value the judging. They value the hectic schedule. They value the boredom. They value whatever it is in their life that they have, that's what they have poured enough energy into to continually manifest in their life. And the text reads, after you ask this question, what do I choose to communicate to the word, to the world? The text reads, for ceaselessly, constantly, continuously, while your body lasts, you are engaged in the process of communicating to the world and making manifest to the world what you have chosen to value, what you have called into your experience and imbued with value. This means that ceaselessly you are engaged in teaching the world whatever it is that you believe holds the greatest truth for you and the greatest value for you. A earlier they were talking about the difference between what an environmentalist sees when he or she looks at a tree and what a logging company or someone who works for a logging company sees when they look at a tree. And here they come back to that and say, when an environmentalist looks upon a logger and becomes exasperated and judges the logger, or the logger judges the environmentalist, body in that moment is being used to communicate they value judgment. I think it's most important for the world to know that I think I'm wrong and other people are right. I think it's most important for the world to understand I think I'm right and everybody else is wrong. Either way, all of us of a certain age have known people who walk around berating themselves, thinking they're stupid, talking about their mistakes, running themselves down. And all of us of a certain age have run into people who think they're the smartest thing and the best thing on the planet since sliced bread. And every time a topic comes up, they've got the perfect answer. And or they're willing to poke fun at anybody else who thinks differently than they do. But every time, this is the text goes on and says, every time we choose judgment, we create fear and contraction. Earlier in this work, it was saying, listen, judgment is the opposite of love. Judgment is the opposite of forgiveness. When we judge, it says in an earlier lesson, if you could understand what happens within your body, the very cellular structure of your body ceases to function well when you are in judgment. And if you could understand that, this text says you would never judge again. You know, and it's one of the stories that Guy Finley told last night had to do with the idea that it's about self-judgment. His whole talk yesterday was about self-judgment. And he told a story about a woman who found herself in a courtroom on the witness stand being yelled at by the prosecutor, being scolded by the judge, and just, you know, trying to defend herself and choking up and stumbling over her words and stammering. And because that's a miserable place to be when you're being judged by someone, and someone apparently who has power or authority over you. Comes to mind to tell a story. Guy Finley liked to tell a story about this young woman who was from a rural area, and her one-year older sister, they were practically twins, had gone off to work in Hollywood. And she worked for one of the biggest, you know, producer directors in the movie industry, and this, you know, very powerful mogul, and he was, you know, Mr. I hate everybody and I'm as rude as can be, Mr. McRude. And this young woman from the rural area went out to visit her sister. And they had agreed that they would meet at a certain time. However, her sister got hung up and she sent a message to her younger sister that was coming in from the rural area and said, you know, go over to the commissary and wait for me, and I'll be there as soon as I can. So the young, naive, shy country girl goes out to L.A., finds her way to the commissary on this big Hollywood studio. The maitre d' sees her coming, knows she's, you know, why she's there, ushers her to a table. She's very nervous. She's afraid people are looking at her. There's, you know, powerful people all around. She knocks over a glass of water and so embarrassed and very nervous. And all of a sudden, Mr. Ultra McRude comes in and marches over to her and starts berating her and her selfishness and how she's holding up the entire production and she's cowering because, you know, she can tell everybody in the place is like shying away from this guy, and he's bellowing and, you know, swearing and calling her rude and lazy and telling her that she's holding up the whole production. And all of a sudden, in the middle of her cowering, it comes to her, oh, he must think I am my sister. My sister must work for this guy. And something in her shifts, Michael Rice would say, the filter in her mind shifts from fear to certainty, or from fear to fearless, or from fear to anger, or whatever you want to call it. But the filter shifted, and she got calm, and she drew herself upright, and she said to Mr. McRude, excuse me, you must have mistaken me for someone you have quite a bit of power over. And that brought this guy up short, and she said simply, I don't answer to you. And he shrank away. Well, that's essentially the same message in Guy Finley's story last night, where this woman found herself in the courtroom being accused of all kinds of things that she never did, and being accused of saying things that she never said, and stammering and trying to be defensive, and eventually coming to her senses and realizing that, wait a minute, she's not supposed to be in this courtroom. She's not supposed to be getting pummeled by the prosecutor and the judge. And she leans over and whispers something to the judge. And they have this conversation, and basically she just tells him, excuse me, Your Honor, I just realized I'm not supposed to be here. With your permission, I'll go now. And the judge, having this realization, says, okay, and she gets up and walks out. And nobody chases her, and nobody tries to arrest her, and because she recognized, wait a minute, all of these negative thoughts coming at me, they aren't accurate. They aren't valid. They don't affect my true nature. All of this judgment that we do is not the truth of our lives. There is this flow of creative energy. And our scientists mark it back to, you know, 13.84 billion years ago at the origination of the Big Bang, when all matter was created and has been flowing forward ever since. And whether or not that's true is irrelevant, but the idea is there is a flow of life. And it's going to proceed as it wants to proceed, or as it unfolds, regardless of my judgment of it. I don't have control over the flow of energy in life. I only have control over whether or not I decide to step back, try and pretend that I'm separate from it, and judge it as right or wrong, good or bad. And I only have control over whether or not I use my intellect to wake up and realize that every time I do that, I create the experience of fear. I create the experience of contraction, whether I'm judging myself or I'm judging somebody else, whether I'm judging somebody else's judgment of me. I'm creating fear and contraction. And the text here says, the result of many, many minds choosing to value the right to judge is what we call our world. This world, this experience we have, this world is this experience of lots of conflict and struggle and war and butting of heads and Armageddon, opposite ideas running into each other, people fighting, people marching, people blowing things up, people shooting at people. And the text says, and just beneath all of that, the dream and the violence and the judgment and just beneath all of that, all is just the flow of creation. And all of the flow of creation is neutral. A hurricane, a tornado, a forest fire, an earthquake, a tsunami, it's just a neutral event until there's a human mind that steps back from it and decides to judge it as one thing or another and throw a label on it. And whatever, whenever that human mind does that, as this book has pointed out to us, in that moment, that human mind calls to itself every association from the past that it has ever decided to value about that word, the tsunami, the earthquake, the tornado, the flooding rainstorm, the drought. It's what we choose to label these events and the value, positive or negative, that we give to them that creates our experience of them. The text goes on and says, even if the forests of your planet were completely taken away, that would be a neutral event. Well, how could that be? Well, because if all of the trees were gone, even if the very physical planet that we call Earth died, dissolved from view, even if that happened, life would still go on. Life would merely create new worlds. It does it all the time. As a matter of fact, with your mind, you do it all the time. As I read that this last time, I flashed on how many times in my life I have been out walking, whether it's here in the Midwest or out in the east in the mountain ranges, south in the mountain ranges, west in the mountain ranges, southwest in the desert mountain ranges. How many times I've been out walking or hiking and I've come across some sign that there had been a man-made structure, and sometimes just a year or two earlier, and it's completely overgrown by nature. And I'm talking about plants that grow up through the sidewalk and the asphalt. I'm talking about buildings that are so overgrown that you can walk right by them and not even realize there was a building there. You know, brick walls that have had plants grow into them and through them, and the roots of the plant tear up the mortar between the bricks, and then the bricks fall over. Water, wind, plant life, animal life, the movement of the force of nature itself just obliterates, we call those things of value. The building, the road, the house, the mall. Occasionally, if you look for it on the internet, on YouTube, if you look at places, what happens when people move out of a house? These are houses that if people were living in them and maintaining them and doing little fixes here and there, 100 years later, this house would still be there. But people move out of the house and leave it for 5 or 10 years, it starts to crumble. Nature will take over. And that's what this book is pointing out. Even if the forests of the planet were completely taken away, life would go on. Not life as we know it, but a different form of life. The energy, the flow of creation, which can't be destroyed, it just changes form. So the book goes on and says, the events then that you experience are always neutral. Your experience of them is not neutral because you judge them and you bring with you all of these associations. But it says what you see occurring in the world around you remains neutral until you make the decision about what it will be for you. You will name it. And therefore, you define it. And when you define it, you call every association you've ever downloaded about this thing, a lizard, a horse, a fish, a tree, a chair. you call that to yourself, and then you project that onto your experience in the moment, and you're not really living in the moment. You're living from the past. Right, you're a Jethro Tull album. Every time you call up a name and label something, what it brings with it into your mind is every association you've ever had about that label, about that word. And you project it onto this piece of the flow of creative energy, this piece of the flow of life. The text goes on and says, this is why I once taught that it's very wise to forgive 77 times 7 times. Why? Because the forgiveness process, as we learned in the third lesson, is dismantling any perception that we create that leaves us feeling negative. Understanding that our negative emotional experience, our tightness, our tension, our physical tension, etc., is best used as an alarm system to alert us to the fact that we have created a distorted perception. We're not seeing life clearly when we have a negative response. And the text goes on and says, this is for a very selfish reason. Because if one wrongs you and you think they've wronged you and you spend your energy convincing them that they have wronged you, you spend your energy convincing yourself that you have a right to be angry, and you spend your energy convincing yourself that you have a right to be attacking of anyone or anything in any way, then you call to yourself, into the very cells of your body, the energy of conflict and judgment and war and death and disease, of unhappiness, of separation. You call this to yourself instantly, irrevocably. You call the negativity into yourself every time you judge. But if you forgive 77 times 70 times, then in each of these moments of forgiveness, of dismantling the false perception, then you call into your field of energy that which reminds you of the flow of life, the flow of creation, unconditional love, perfect peace, the power that transcends anything and everything that arises in this world. Call to yourself your awareness of your participation in the Christ mind itself. And this all hinges on which thoughts you choose to value. This reference to forgiving 77 times 7 times is not a literal number. Michael Rice loves to point this out. In the way they talked about numbers and numerology and the meaning of numbers, 7 was a number of completion. And if you added a 0 to a number, it meant infinity. So the answer to how many times do we need to do a process that dismantles our false perceptions is we need to do it an infinite number of times until it is complete. So please don't get hung up with the numbers game. Just understand, in any new present moment, it's a possibility that I create a false perception. The system is designed to let me know when that happens because I will feel tension. I will be moved into judgment. I will feel pain or sadness or hurt. If I choose to be awake and aware, if I choose to use the alarm system for the way it was designed, I can call a timeout for myself, turn the focus inside, do whatever breathing pattern brings me some calm and softening and moves me into relaxation, and start to ask, how am I creating this upset? How have I made a mistake in my judgment and my perception? And I can start to undo the effects of my errors in thought. I can even ask to be shown, which engages this higher power, this Ruka Dukuja, this elemental force specific to humans that's in each and every one of us that's there to break off the effects of our errors in thought and help guide us to truth and happiness if we just ask it to. Remember the great line, I forget who said it, but if you argue for your limitations, they are yours. No one can take them from you. In this book, it has said several times already in just the first 9 lessons, these entities that have gone before us, these guides, spirit teachers, they cannot make the choice for us. They will wait with infinite patience if we choose to stay stuck in bitterness and hurt and resentment and anger. They may not come visit us very often, but they will give up their love for us, their affection for us, their ability to see our true value. But they will wait with infinite patience until we choose to understand that when we are in pain, we are in error. That when we are in pain, our thoughts are in error. That when we are in pain, our pain is best used as an alarm system to wake us up to the fact that we have been using the process of thought to create the problem that we are now trying to fix with thought. It won't work. So what can we do? Here's what the intellect can do. It can't solve this problem, but it can be used to identify for ourselves how we are creating the problem. And the next section is titled, Look with Innocence on What You Value. So this is what I can do with my intellect. I can start questioning, what do I really value? What am I spending all of my time doing? Because that will show me what I value. If I can use my intellect to really honestly take a look at what I value. I just backed away from the book. I'm not going to read anymore. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about what Michael Rice talked about. I heard him talk about it a few days ago. He talked about tithing. And so many people have been introduced to tithing as this idea that you have to take 10% of whatever money you make and give it to whatever religious group that you're affiliated with. And Michael Rice says, you know, tithing is this wonderful energetic practice, this spiritual law of resonance energetic practice that says 10% of your time, intelligence, money, and energy should go into the things that feed you physically, mentally, emotionally, etc. And so here we are with the idea that you do what you value. So if you step back and take a look at where you spend your time and energy, especially if you're one of those people who's not very happy with the way your life is going, then you can do what the next section of Chapter 9 is asking us to do. Look with innocence upon what you value. Use your intellect as this tool to help you make an assessment of what are you spending all of your time, intelligence, money, and energy on, because that's what's producing the results in your life, whether you like them or not. And if you do that, you step back without beating yourself up, without bemoaning, without getting caught in judgment, just with childlike curiosity. Oh, you know what? I say I want to know God, or I want to reach enlightenment, or I want, you know, to be in a loving spiritual community, or I want this or that. And the fact of the matter is, I'm not spending very much of my time, intelligence, money, and energy each and every day working towards that. I'm spending a lot of time judging it as bad or wrong, complaining that I don't have it, thinking about what I want, thinking about all the things I don't have that I do want. Oh, well, so Michael Rice says, so the tithing that's recommended is that you step back and use your intellect to look at what you truly value and what you're spending your time doing and you're spending your money on, and you're spending your energy on your good creative energy, your live awake time in the day, and start spending 10% of it on things that are specifically designed to give you the experiences you say you want. So if you look at the day as having 24 hours, 2.4 hours is 10%, and this is the recommendation. Find a way to spend 2.5 hours of your day doing things that you really want more of, whether it's reading spiritual texts or meditating or donating your time to your favorite spiritual community or spending time finding a spiritual community that you feel comfortable in, that you like spending time with, that you want to spend more time with. Yes, if you choose to, you can spend some of your money, you can spend 10% of your money developing that or donating to the people that nourish you physically, mentally, and emotionally, spiritually, etc. But it's your time, it's your intelligence, and your energy that are so critical to what you experience in your life. And that's, you know, last night in the group, people were asking, well, then what? Well, then what? Various forms of the question. Yes, but then what should I do? How do I do that? And this is the answer. Use your intellect to make an assessment, to step back without judgment, with this childlike innocence, with innocence, question for yourself. See clearly what you have chosen to value. And you will know what you have chosen to value when you look honestly on at what are you spending your time doing. If you're spending 4 or 5 hours a day looking at a computer screen or watching television or, you know, laying around playing video games or computer games, that's what you value. And and there's nothing wrong with any of those things. If you value those and that's making your life enjoyable and blissful and happy, do more of it. If, however, you're spending, you know, at the end of a work day, let's say that you work 8 or 9 hours a day, and then there's a 3 or 4 hour period after the housework is done and the meals are made or whatever, there's 3 or 4 hours in the evening before you have to go to bed so you can get up and have the energy to do the day. If in that 3 or 4 hours what you're doing is watching videos or scanning the internet or playing video games with people, and then you find yourself complaining about any aspect of your life, you might want to use some of that time consciously directing it towards creating differently in your life. And, of course, this is just an overall view. The idea of tithing as an ancient spiritual practice is 10% of your time, your intelligence, your money, and your energy. You can keep all your money to yourself if you want, but please understand that everything you do with your time, everything you do with your intelligence, everything you do with your energy is what is creating your experience of life. This was what Lesson 8 was all about. This is that every time I choose a thought, I am placing value on that thought. Every time I choose a thought and pour my mind energy into it, it creates more ripples going out from me, more ripples that will be coming back to me, and they will be creating my experience of tomorrow. So that's the end of our show for today. The second hour coming up is going to be a replay of the On Creating Consciously, today the first session, and tomorrow the second session. I would like to remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Thank you for the comments, Celinda. Have a lovely day, and blessings.
Welcome to On Creating Consciously, a workshop that looks at the way that we as human beings create our lives, how we create every situation in our lives, and what responsibility would look like if we were aware of the fact that we are creative beings. Probably the greatest atrocity done to us as human beings down through the ages is that we've had hidden from us the fact that our basic nature is that of creatorship, that we're made in the image and likeness of the Creator. And so I want to take a look at the whole process of life and what part we play in setting that up, and some tools for perhaps catching parts of ourselves that set up those situations that we say to ourselves, you know, why is this happening to me again? That, of course, is the title of the main workshop that we do, the title of our book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? It's kind of interesting to get the phone calls we get at Heartland. People will hear about the book and we'll get a phone call saying, do you have this book called Why Are They Doing This to Me Again? Or Why Am I Doing This to Myself Again? We get all kinds of interesting titles. You can sort of tell a lot about what's going on in people's lives by the way they ask for that book. In any event, how many people here tonight brought a body with you? How many brought a body? Let me see a show of hands. Most everybody puts their hand up. Okay. How many think that in that body that you brought with you, there's such thing as chemistry? How many have chemistry happening in their bodies? Most everybody says yes. Well, we're going to be at variance tonight because I don't agree with you. I intend to prove to you that you did not bring a body with you tonight. I intend to prove to you who are watching this video that you do not have a body and that there's no such thing as chemistry. Well, it sounds like a tall order. Where do we start to look into that one? Well, let's start, and I'd like to quote Einstein. Einstein is considered probably the greatest genius, or one of the greatest geniuses of all time, especially in the area of science. And it's interesting with his theory of relativity that he said that his theory of relativity would be of more interest to theologians than it would be to physicists, because he knew the implications that tie in with who we really are and how this whole process of life is created. And it's interesting how long it takes for scientists or so-called scientists to catch up with good science. Einstein says this, "On such things as matter, we have been all wrong. What we have heretofore called matter is energy, energy whose vibrations have been so lowered as to be perceptible to the senses. There is no matter." Einstein says there is no matter. So when you say you brought a body with you, what you're saying is Einstein isn't right. Because, of course, if there are bodies, there has to be matter. Well, gee, Michael, you've got a lot of nerve standing up there waving that chunk of matter around in front of me, telling me there's no such thing as matter. Well, I'm going to invite you to look differently at what we call matter and start to see that what we've called matter and the beliefs that we have in matter perhaps entrap us in something that isn't true. And being entrapped in something as creative beings, we create certain results over and over and over again, and we say, well, that's just the way life, that's just the way the world is. Or that's just the way I am. And it's not true that that's the way life, the world, or you are. That's the way you're creating, your creative process is operating. And when you change the nature of your creative process, then you'll see changes where it seemed previously that changes were impossible. And so I want to look into this idea of that there is no matter. Another statement Einstein makes that I really love is a statement that says that you can't solve a problem with the mind that created it. In other words, if your mind is the device through which you create and your mind doesn't know what's going on, then you're trapped in the process. And so you have to be removed from the process. And the most ancient mechanism for removing people from that process was called a parable. You go back and you listen to in the book of Matthew, it speaks about the teachings of a man named Jesus. And our work tonight will look into, in a certain perspective, into especially the Aramaic teachings of Jesus. Jesus spoke Aramaic as his native language. And in that native language, he did not teach theology. He taught law. And if you listen, he says, not I come not to destroy theology or I come not to destroy religion. He says, I come not to destroy the law. And then he says an interesting thing. We're told in the Greek translations that he said, I come to fulfill the law. But in Aramaic, what he said is, I come to add unto the law, or add unto your understanding of the law. And so to understand the lawful, orderly process by which we create is what he said he was here to teach us. And a parable, if you listen to Matthew, it says, without a parable he did not teach. There are many who want to try and find literal words and literal meanings, but if without a parable he did not teach, everything had a parallel meaning. In the Aramaic language, the word parable means parallel meaning. And so I'd like to present a parable for this idea that there's no such thing as matter and you don't have a body. Let's take a look. If we brought someone from the jungles who had never experienced something more complex than a dugout canoe, and we took him to the airport where we had a propeller already spinning. The motor on this airplane is started. The propeller is spinning when our friend from the jungle shows up. He looks at the airplane propeller, and what does he see? Does he see a pivot point with four arms rotating around it? No, he sees a shiny silver disc. He has an image show up in his mind. That's not true. He experiences a shiny silver disc. Where does the shiny silver disc exist? Anywhere in the world? Absolutely nowhere. The only place it exists is in his mind. And his mind creates an appearance. His mind creates an illusion. His mind shows him something that isn't there. And so if you listen 2,000 years ago, the master said, do not judge by appearance. Why? Because the mind shows you things that aren't true. You get experiences from the mind that never happened. The shiny silver disc never happened anywhere in the world, did it? Though it showed up and was experienced in his mind. Now, why doesn't he see four arms organized around a pivot point? Well, the rate of spin of the propeller is so fast that his antenna, called the eye, and the brain cells that fire in response to the information the eye receives don't operate quickly enough to show him what's actually happening. And so the mind, not being able to keep up with the rate of spin, makes its best guess. And its best guess is totally illusion. It isn't what happened. And so if he judges by appearance, let's imagine our friend from the jungle holds on to the incorrect understanding that this thing in front of him is a shiny silver disc, and he wants to see what the friction would feel like on his fingertips if he touches the shiny silver disc. What happens, having judged by that appearance? Big mistake, right? Very sore fingers, if there are any left. Because he's dealing with an image that's true in his mind, but isn't true in the world. He makes a very grave error. Well, in precisely the same fashion, if we look at this world of so-called bodies, if we could see what was actually there, we'd see this whirring mass of electrons, protons, neutrons, etc. We would not see matter. We would see energy in motion. But because in the same way the mind can't keep up with the rate of spin of the propeller, the mind can't keep up with the rate of spin of this atomic structure. And so it creates an image, an illusion. It shows us something that isn't there. Now, someone would say, well, but Michael, I see it, I can touch it, I can feel it. Obviously, it's there. And obviously, it's solid because, look, when you clap your hands together, they don't go through each other. They just stop right there. Why? If it's not solid. Well, let's imagine for a moment that one of my hands was made of radio waves. What happens when I clap my hands together if one hand is made of radio waves? It goes right through the other hand, right? Obviously, it's not solid if the radio wave will go through it. Why does it appear solid when I put my hands together that are so-called flesh? It appears solid because the two energies are in resonance with each other, and it's the energy interchange between the two that makes the appearance of solid, that causes the energy exchange to happen that stops one hand from going through the other. One hand made of radio waves passes through. Now, what would happen if both of my hands were made of radio waves? They would appear solid to each other again, wouldn't they? But only because they are matching frequencies. They are similar frequencies. So when we start to understand something about this energy system, what we'll see is that this isn't matter, but that it's energy. And we'll see that as an energy system, something organizes the energy system. So we see that this thing is organized. It turns into organic structure. And unless we understand the something that sets up that structure, we're going to think that whatever's in the structure must be natural. And we're not going to be able to go to the cause level of that something to change it. Though we as human beings have the faculty that allows us to go to cause level in that process. But if we're stuck in an illusion, we can't go to cause. We'll keep trying to change the effect. Now, what would changing an effect look like? Let's imagine that our friend from the jungles, we bring him in and we sit him down in a chair, and we have a solid concrete wall over there, white painted wall, and we project onto that wall a picture of a table, and there's a bottle on the table. Now imagine that we explain to our friend from the jungles that if he can move the bottle from one side of the table to the other, he can have whatever reward he wants, anything he asks for. Hey, this looks like a pretty simple task, eh? Now remember, this is a projected image. It's in 3D. This fellow knows nothing about cameras, projection booths, etc. And so he goes over to pick the bottle up and move it from one side of the table to the other. And what happens? He's dealing with an effect. The bottle doesn't move. Now you can imagine all of the gyrations he might go through to try to move the bottle. But it's not going to move, is it? Until he deals with the original. Imagine you come in the room and he explains to you what he's trying to do, so you hand him a jackhammer. What does he do? He takes the jackhammer and he punches a hole in the wall in an attempt to move the bottle, but the bottle remains right where it was. Because he's trying to change an effect. So imagine here he stands, he's just punched this huge hole in the concrete. He's sweaty, he's hot, he's thirsty. And you come in and he explains what it is he's trying to accomplish. And you say, well, tell you what, here's a cool drink, have a seat, relax. I'll be right back. You have the key for the projector booth. You go back to the projector booth, you open it, you go in, you walk over, you pick the bottle up, you move it from one side of the table to the other, and he's amazed. It's a miracle. Everything he tried to do wouldn't move the bottle. And you come back out. Could you imagine him wanting to worship you for the miracle that you've performed? Could you imagine him following on his hands and knees? Oh, look what you were able to do. And might you say something to him like, gee, you know the things I do, you can do, and even greater, if you know how the system works. But if you don't know where cause lies, obviously it looks really difficult to move the bottle. Well, the same thing happens if we don't understand the lawful, orderly process that organizes this energy system called life. And so we want to look into what it is that's at cause in that process. And start to see beyond matter. Now, the second question I asked you was about chemistry. Well, Michael, obviously there must be chemistry. I mean, we've got universities that teach all about it. People spend years studying it. I had a professor in Indianapolis about 4 years ago when I did this workshop come up to me afterward. He was a professor of chemistry at a local university. And he said, you know something, Michael? You're right. We don't have a clue what we're talking about. He teaches the subject at a university level. I don't know what I'm talking about. What is chemistry? Well, if we go to the opening words in the book of John, they key us into what's going on in this process that we would call the creative process. And the opening words in the book of John, contrary to what we're told, do not say, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh, as we're told it does. In the Aramaic language, in the original words, what is said there is that in the beginning was the mind energy. And the mind energy became flesh. Now we've got a clue as to what's going on. What we're told there is that what becomes flesh is mind energy. Now you listen to Einstein, and Einstein almost says exactly the same thing. Einstein says there's no such thing as matter. What we have heretofore called matter is energy. Now, he perhaps didn't have the peace that it was mind energy, but he said energy becomes matter. You'd almost think he was reading from the book of John. If you go back into the Aramaic language, and the Aramaic language is the native language of five of the world's major religions, and I'd offer the reason why those religions have hung around so long is because they come out of a system of understanding that understood cause. They come out of a physics language, out of a culture that understood more about physics than we still understand yet today, that understood more about how we operate and how this mind operates. They knew enough to say that in the beginning of the so-called flesh world is the mind energy. Now let's take a look at that on a practical level in regard to chemistry. Imagine that our friend from the jungles comes to visit. Well, let's start a little earlier in the process. Let's see in regard to chemistry. We're going to talk about that. Let's imagine that we want to find you in an awake state, or relatively awake, but in your most level chemical condition, where your so-called chemistry would be as level as we might find you. And a good example that most people can identify with is, how many have ever driven, say, the interstate system over a period of 20 years, every day back and forth to the office? And some days you pull into your parking place at the office, and as you put your foot on the brake, you kind of shake your head, and it's like, oh my God, how did I get here? Anybody ever had that one? Or you get home and it's not till after you're in your garage that you realize you just drove 15 miles. Anybody ever done that on the interstate system? It's like a blotto. Would you say that if somebody were in the back seat measuring your chemistry, that you're in probably about the most level chemical condition we'd find you? Would that be a reasonable assumption? I think it probably would be. So let's imagine that you're driving along the interstate and we're measuring your chemistry. And you look up ahead of you on the right-hand side of the road, and there's a set of blue lights flashing, or depending on what state you're in, maybe red lights flashing. What's going to happen to your chemistry? Or you look in your rearview mirror, and there's a set of blue or red lights flashing. What's going to happen to your chemistry? What's going to happen? You're going to get a flood of adrenaline, right? Or, well, wait a minute now. If chemistry doesn't exist, how can you have a flood of adrenaline? I would offer that adrenaline doesn't exist. Adrenals don't exist. There's no such thing. Well, how can you say that, Michael? I mean, you acknowledge that there's adrenaline that you can measure. I'd offer that it's not adrenaline that we're measuring. That's an illusion. That's like the shiny silver disc. It looks like it's there, but it really isn't. Let's ask our friend from the jungles to ride along beside you on this journey where we're measuring your chemistry. And we're going to measure his too. And again, every time I use the word chemistry, I put it in quotes. So we're measuring the chemistry in both of your so-called bodies. We're putting the word bodies in quotes too. Now, imagine the red lights, the blue lights flash behind you. And our friend from the jungle notices that there's something going on for you. Something has happened. It's rather obvious by your reaction. And so he somehow communicates that he wants to know what's up for you, what's going on. And you rather excitedly turn and point to the blue or red lights behind you. Now, he turns and he looks, and of course the blue lights cause this agitated chemistry and this adrenaline flow, right? But he looks, does he have an adrenaline flow? No, he looks and he just wow, what a great color, right? He doesn't have the same mind energy that you do about blue lights. What kind of mind energy is resonated in you? That is, resonance adds energy to something. There's an energy in you. The blue lights show up and resonate or add energy to that. What energy do you have in your system about blue lights that our friend from the jungle simply doesn't have? What is it?
Worry about it.
Yeah, you got the mind energy of fear, right? But he doesn't have any mind energy of fear. Now, blue lights cause adrenaline to pump in the system. Obviously, he should have as much adrenaline running as you do. But he doesn't. And the only difference between you and he is he has no mind energy of fear about blue lights. And I would offer that what shows up as that flood of adrenaline in the system is really the resonance of the mind energy of fear. And when that mind energy of fear solidifies, it looks like what we call the chemical adrenaline. And I'd offer that every piece of mind energy that we engage in builds an organic structure to flow through. The mind energy that you engage in, organizes. In other words, when there's enough mind energy of fear, there will develop in the system an organ to express that fear. And that organ is a solidified energy form. And we, when we can reach behind to cause, can start to change the energy form that produces that expression, that so-called chemical. Now let's take it one more step. Let's imagine that you go with our friend from the jungles to the jungle for a visit. Imagine it's a beautiful, sunny, wonderful day, 76 degrees, it's just perfect. And there you are being guided around through these lush, beautiful forests. And all of a sudden, our friend from the jungles gets the whiff, the odor of a rattlesnake. Now, what happens if we're following him and measuring his chemistry? What are we going to find? There's probably going to be a rush of what we call adrenaline, but what we really know is that he's got the mind energy of fear about rattlesnakes. And so what's really showing up when he smells and therefore knows there's a rattlesnake nearby? What shows up is the mind energy of fear resonates in his structure. Now, let's imagine that, like he did with you in the car, you notice that there's something going on for him. And somehow you're able to communicate with him. What is it? Now, he can go through all the gyrations that he wants in his native language to tell you about rattlesnakes. And while you might get from his agitation there's something going on, there's not going to be any really specific response likely, is there? But let's imagine that he gets out his little translator book, thumbs through it, and in his agitated state, rattlesnake! What happens to your chemistry? The minute the mind energy of fear is resonated, you have a flood of it. And I'd offer you don't have a flood of adrenaline. You have a flood of the mind energy of fear. What we have in this energy system called the body is a device that solidifies energy. And we have a lot more to do with how this system operates than we've been led to believe. In fact, if you go back 2,000 years ago, and again, that Aramaic language is so incredible. I know when I first found it, my background's in electronics, and when I first found the Aramaic, it was very clear to me this was a physics language. This is a language that expresses and understands energy systems theory. And so you listen to people in that language asking this master who has spent decades studying and understanding how the system works. They say to him, look, bottom line it. How does this thing work? What's going on here? And there's a lawful process that he referred to. And you know, a lawyer when a lawyer does a study of the laws are usually written in code. And the process of figuring out what the code says is called code pleading. If you go to an attorney, if you go to a lawyer and you say, gee, you know, I've got this legal question, give me an answer, chances are the lawyer's going to go, he's going to get out all these reference materials and reference the codes on that particular legal point. He's going to go to the court decisions on that particular legal point. He's going to do the same thing. He's going to study that code, and his final analysis will be the result of this code pleading process. Well, 2,000 years ago, Jesus had done the code pleading process for how life works. And they asked him, how does it work? What's going on here? And he reduced the whole body of the law to three simple words. Three words that not even a Philadelphia lawyer could misinterpret. He said, folks, here's how it works. Ask, and you receive. Now that makes it pretty simple. And what that means is, of course, if you've received, then somehow you have asked. And you better figure out how the asking process goes. And I would offer that the asking process goes by engaging in mind energy. That's all you have to do to ask for a result in your life. So be careful where you allow your mind to go, because where your mind goes, your energy system follows. Now, many people want to blame others for what's going on in their lives. When things are going well, of course, it's easy to own. You know, look how great it is. Wow, look what I've done. But when it's not going so well, don't we always know who the problem is? And isn't the problem usually them? If only they would be different. Well, this one doesn't let you off the hook. Ask and you receive. If something comes to you, it is a product of your asking. Life is nothing but construction and delivery. That's all it is. Construction and delivery. And what you ask for, life must deliver to you. Now, of course, many people will say, well, how did I ask for this? You've got to start to look at where your mind has been. And part of where your mind has been is in your whole environmental and genetic history, your whole life. And if you go back into the Aramaic language where they understood, they said the sins of the Father, now we could add the blessings too, the sins, the blessings of the Father will be passed, yea, unto three and four generations. In other words, if you engage in an energy, this energy is stored in your structure. I would offer this so-called body-mind unit is a device that registers absolutely everything that comes to it. And as a device that registers everything that comes to it, every thought, every feeling, every emotion, every reality you've ever engaged in is stored as an energy holographically in every cell in your structure, including the sperm and the egg. Were you to conceive a child tomorrow, that child would have in its structure every thought you've ever thought, every feeling you've ever felt, every reality you've ever engaged in, as you have the previous generations from your structure. When they said the sins of the Father will be passed, yea, into three and four generations, that wasn't some kind of a theological threat or the punishment of a punishing God. That was simply the way the energy system works. You put an energy in, and it passes from generation to generation. In fact, if you go back and you listen to that story about, remember, the Jews wandered in the desert for 40 years? And I'll bet if we ask the average person in our audience, the average person that's watching this video, at what age you started to question and wonder what was really going on, I'll bet if we averaged it all out, we'd find that the average age is about 40 years. That word desert in the scriptures means the unconscious. Most people wander unconsciously for about 40 years before they start to wonder what's really going on here. Anybody ever feel like your 40 years should be up? And remember, the Jews wandered for 40 years in the desert. Now, you know, there's a reason why they wandered for 40 years. You know what that reason is? Moses would not stop and ask for directions. That's why they, no, I'm just kidding. But why did they wander for 40 years? Remember, there was something that had to happen before they could get into the promised land. What is the promised land? The promised land is the land of conscious co-creation. You put your asking in the system. There's nothing that's out of harmony in you for that asking, and you simply bring about that result. So the Jews wandered for 40 years in the desert, and they couldn't get into the promised land until what happened? They said the old generation had to die off. Did that mean everybody in old physical bodies had to physically die? No, the root of the word generation is genari, which means cause. All of the old causes in the energy system, all of the old mind energy had to be removed before you could get to a new creation, the promised land, before you could do it differently. And so your asking produces the result of construction and delivery within your life. Now, a lot of people didn't want to hear that 2,000 years ago. They said, no, I can't accept that. Just, you know, tell me how it really works. He says, okay, let me tell you in a different way. Let me say words differently, and maybe this time you'll grasp. And you know, your attorney might, after he's given you the result of his code plea, and you kind of roll your eyes around and say, what are you talking about, might try to say it in a different way. So here he says it a little bit differently than ask and you shall receive. And he quotes, you go back into the Old Testament, and you hear it stated there a little differently, only in this case it comes directly from the Creator. And the Creator says this, of the works of my hands, so there's the effect world, the works of the hands of the Creator, it says, command ye me. Here's God that says, you tell me what you want and I'll go to work and I'll produce it in your life. That's a pretty clear statement of how this process of creating goes. And because we have all of the creation of our past generations stored in us, oftentimes we ask for things that we're not even cognizant of, that we're not conscious of, things that have been implanted in us from the previous generations. And so when you recognize that that's another statement of this creative process, that the works of the Creator's hands, because the Creator has said to you, and you can almost imagine the Creator. The Creator's been in charge of all life up until humans appear. Nobody argues with the Creator. I mean, would you think of a pair of robins coming back? Let's say you live in this place where the robins go south for the winter. The robins come back, and this pair of robins land in your backyard. One turns to the other and says, you know, dear, we've been building a robin's nest every year for the last 5 years in this beautiful backyard, and I think this year we should build an Oriole model. You think the robin's ever going to do that? It's not going to happen. The robin has no choice but to build a robin's nest. Imagine we've got a salmon in the South Pacific, and the salmon gets the call to go back to the place where it was spawned. Can you imagine the salmon responding to that? Excuse me, I beg your pardon, you say what? You want me to do what? Uh-huh, yeah. Wait a minute, let me get this clear. You want me to swim from these nice, warm South Pacific waters, 3,000 miles to that icy cold stream where I was spawned. You want me to swim upstream against the rocks, get beat half to death on those rocks, legs, and die? You're crazy, I'm staying here. You're not going to find a salmon that does that. The salmon gets the call, it's told what to do, and it goes and it does it. No questions asked. There's no creature we know of that can consciously originate mind energy but you and I. And you can almost imagine the Creator that has run all of life going within and saying, okay, I'm going to carry out whatever you ask me for. You tell me what you want. You tell me. Now, still people maybe didn't want to hear that. So Jesus said, well, let me tell you a different way that you might be able to hear it. It is going to be done unto you. According to your faith. In other words, what you hold as the mind energy about a thing, if you hold that it's a poverty-stricken world, if you hold that it's a dangerous world, then that's where your faith lies. That's where the energy of your mind goes, and you'll produce exactly that result because you are a creative being, and the Creator said, tell me what you want. You don't want to hear it that way? Well, let's listen another way. Seek, and you will find. So we were told in many, many different ways what the creative process looks like in this energy system called life and what part we have to play with it. Now, when they said to him, well, how do you tell where somebody's really at? How do you tell where this mind energy system is? He said, well, that's easy. You tell where the mind energy system is by the fruit that it produces. How do you tell? Well, you just look at the results. You look at the fruit, and you know exactly what's going on. Well, but I don't see how that fits. That doesn't make sense to me. I ask for wonderful things and terrible things happen in my life. That obviously isn't true, that you just look at the fruit to see where somebody's mind energy's at. And he said, well, you know, there's one more little hook. And that is that you have an unconscious mind. There's a part of you that's hidden from yourself. And so they said, you must take care of the heart. For out of it are the issues in life. And that word heart in a modern updated language would be the unconscious. They want to credit Freud, with discovering the unconscious. Freud no more discovered the unconscious than fly in the air. It was understood thousands of years ago. Only it was called the heart instead of the unconscious. So they said, take care what you hide from yourself, because the mind energy that you hide from yourself will be at an unconscious or a heart level, and whatever the strongest resonating energy in you is will produce the result in your life. So if you're not sure what that is, if you're not sure what's hidden in your heart, then you have to look at the results you produce, and the results that you produce will reflect exactly what's going on in your heart. And when you take that kind and that quality and that level of responsibility, responsibility becomes a tool for being able to access the hidden parts of your mind, for being able to access the unconscious. And as you're able to access it, you're able to take charge of it, and you're able to change it. And many people still want, however, to hang out and blame. No, it must be all their fault. It's got to be somebody else's fault. And let me just go sock it to them one more time. You know, I want to be able to do violence to those who've done it to me, basically is what they were saying. And the master said, well, I got one more piece of information for you that's really important to look at. You want to take out your sword and go after somebody for what's going on in your life? Well, those who live by the sword, are going to die by the sword. They'll die exactly the same way. Because this process of life is a creative process. We think, we have these people in the world, we'll just go make war on them and we'll get rid of those bad guys. But what we don't realize is that in the making of war are the seeds for the next war. It is a creative act. It engages in mind energy that produces a like result. We can't do enough violence to get rid of violence, because violence itself is a creative act. If you go back, the master said that the key lie in being able to stand as a space of love. In fact, you could almost interpret him saying, anything that's on the right-hand side of this equation, anyone that you see that you think has produced these results in your life, he said, in order to really take charge of your life and in order to heal, you had to be able to stand with the mind of love. You had to be able to hold the condition of love in your mind. When you thought of anybody on this side of the equation that you had been blaming for what was going on in your life. And what that means is that you step into a space of love, and at the same time you step into a space of responsibility. And responsibility doesn't mean we're to blame for what's going on. It just means that everything that shows up in our lives, that there's a part of us that's involved in that process. And when we recognize that there's a part of us involved in everything that happens, then responsibility becomes the way to access the hidden part of the mind, that which is in the heart. Because until you take responsibility, that part of the mind isn't going to be available to you. You're not going to be able to see it. So to take care of the unconscious, or to take care of the heart, to take responsibility for the issues that show up in your life, and to find the part of you that needs to be changed in order to make it different, becomes the key. And usually when people go through the process of healing, they step through several different levels of energy in doing it. And the levels that they step through are very identifiable. And it's a good thing to have a handle on what that process is going to look like. Because what's going to happen as you step through the process of really taking responsibility for your life is that healing's going to happen. And healing doesn't always feel and look good. And so when we look at how we create abundance, and when we talk about abundance in this creative process, we're talking about abundance in every area of life. We're talking physical, mental, emotional, relationship, financial, health, aliveness, joy. We're talking about every aspect. And I'll get the person who says, well, Michael, wait a minute now. You know, I hear what you're saying there, and that ask and you receive. And you know, I've been, for the last 20 years, praying for money. Now, every day I pray for money. I said, okay, well, that's interesting. And so what's happening? Well, I'm still in poverty. I don't understand it. Why isn't my prayer being answered? Well, let's investigate. Let's see. How much time do you spend doing this prayer process you're talking about? Oh, well, I usually 10 minutes in the morning, 10 minutes at night, 20 minutes a day I focus on and pray for money, for abundance in my life. Okay, so now we've determined what you do with your mind energy for 20 minutes of the day. Let's look at the other 23 hours and 50 minutes. What do you do? Well, you know, I mean, life is tough. I mean, I struggle. I work three jobs to make ends meet. I can hardly ever pay the bills. There's just never enough money. I mean, it's always been tough. It's always a stress. It's always over. I can just never catch up. There just isn't enough. Oh, so what you're telling me is that once you get your 8 hours sleep underway, and probably a good part of that still stays in the worry about money, is that you spend most of your time focused on the fact that there's lack, that there's not enough, and that there never will be enough. Which prayer do you suppose is the strongest? The one where you sit quietly and say, God, give me money today, please? Or the one that says, oh my God, there's not enough money? And that prayer that goes on for 12, 13, 14 waking hours. You sit and you write checks to the electric company? Do you whine, do you moan, and you complain every time you write a check to the electric company? If so, then the mind energy that you engage in as you complain about the electric bill is too high and I can't afford to pay it, and you send that money out with resentment, guess what? The universe has to respond to that mind energy and produce the result. And so what's the result going to look like? Well, money's going to come to you grudgingly and sparingly. You know, when the master spoke about this creative process, he said, here's another way to say it. As you sow, you will reap. And if you sow sparingly, you will reap sparingly. He was speaking about the creative process. If you can't joyfully and with abundance pay the electric bill, get rid of the electricity. Because paying for it with the grudge means that you send a message to the universe that says, Universe, send me money with a grudge. If you pay for the phone and you complain about how expensive it is and how you can't afford it, you just amplify the mind energy of there's not enough, and the universe has to respond accordingly. It can't give you anything different than that. If you can't pay for it with abundance and appreciation and delight, then get rid of the phone until you can appreciate it or any service in your life. And bring those services back in when with abundance you can say, I'm sure delighted that I can have this. I'm sure delighted that I've got the abundance to pay for this. I love paying my phone bill. I appreciate the service that I get. Now, you send that message out to the universe and the universe will start to respond by sending you money with appreciation attached instead of resentment attached. But you've got to decide the way that it works. The universe is going to follow your lead. Now, I like to tell the story about, you know, oftentimes we speak in churches and we'll go to churches and you look at how many people who are still living maybe 25 years ago in the mindset where they would go into a gas station and buy a dollar's worth of gas, and they'd actually be able to drive off the gas station lot with that dollar's worth of gas. Now today, nobody would think about going and putting a dollar's worth of gas in their car because you'd hardly get off the lot. You wouldn't have enough gas to get on the lot and back off of it with that dollar, hardly. But you know, it's interesting, they go to church and they see this large church, et cetera, et cetera, and they think when they put a dollar in the collection plate, they've really done something meaningful. Never realizing. I like to tell the story about the $100 bill and the $1 bill that meet at the shredding plant, you know, at the mint, where they take all the old torn bills and such. And the $100 bill and the $1 bill meet, and they have a conversation, and the $100 bill's bragging about, you know, I've been to Rome, I've been to Paris, I've been to all the finest restaurants, all the finest clubs in the world. I'm ready to go. I've lived a full life. And the dollar bill responds and says, oh, I'm not ready to go. All I've ever done is gone to church. And you look at how people, how they support what supports them. And then they wonder why they're reaping sparingly. Step into abundance. And abundance doesn't have to do with quantity. Remember, Jesus used an example of the woman who had what was called a widow's mite. Now, a widow's mite today would probably be the equivalent of a few pennies. And he used the example of that woman, and he said, now here's a woman who did something with abundance. Here's a woman who went in with only pennies to offer, and her pennies were more meaningful, not because of quantity. Her pennies were more meaningful because of the mind energy that she gave it with. She gave it with abundance and with appreciation. And there was quantity attached relative to where she was. And then he used the example of the wealthy person who goes to the same place and gives 100,000 times as much, and it's meaningful because it's not done with the idea of support. It's not done with the mind energy of abundance. It's done with the mind energy of, well, let me make sure everybody sees what I'm doing. That's an ego game. And that the widow's mite produced more of a result of abundance and was more of a symbol of abundance. And so it's not to do with quantity. It's got to do with the mind energy connected. I can remember the point where I switched into doing spiritual work. I switched into doing this type of teaching. And I had come from a background that taught me that to do spiritual work was to live in poverty. And prior to switching into doing this work, I was in business. I had three businesses. I had 60 employees. I had a Mark III on one side of my driveway. I had an Eldorado on the other. And I came to the point where I was guided and knew that my purpose was to do this work. And so I left the business world, went back to school, and started to study full-time and to teach full-time. And for a period of about almost 7 years doing this work, I lived in total poverty. I mean, didn't know how we were going to feed the kids the next meal sometimes. And I can remember the very moment at which the shift happened for me. I was in Florida. We had moved to the North Georgia mountains, and I was starting to work on a book at that point. My daughter had just been born. She's now 18. And we had moved in Let's see, she was born in August. Pardon me, she was born in May. We moved in August to the mountains. And December 24th, our pipes froze. And we couldn't stay in the house. It was going to take about 10 days to get them fixed. The house was new and it wasn't properly insulated. And so we had some friends that had been asking us to come to Florida. So we got in the car, went to Florida to visit and to do a couple of workshops while we were there. And we ended up being invited to a center in Fort Lauderdale to teach a series of workshops there. And I did a six-week series, and the sixth week, the title of the workshop, they had asked me in advance to give them some titles, so the title of the workshop that I gave them was, Still Waiting for Your Ship to Come In? Which One Did You Send Out? Was the title. Well, I was staying up in North Palm Beach and driving back and forth from North Palm Beach to Fort Lauderdale each Wednesday night to do this workshop. And it was the last Wednesday, the last in the series. The next day, we were going to pack up and go back to North Georgia. Well, I'm on my way down there, and I've got about $102 in my pocket. I've got two kids. We're in South Florida. We're going to drive back and get set up to live again in North Georgia. $100 isn't going to go very far. So I'm driving down the interstate contemplating this, and I'd already asked the friends that I was staying with, you know, or had checked with them to see if I might borrow some money to get us back there and get us set up. And they said, well, let me check it out and we'll see. So I'm driving down I-95, and I get to about Lantana Road, and I'm contemplating what I'm going to do with this workshop, Still Waiting for Your Ship to Come In. And all of a sudden I get this guidance that, Michael, you either believe in this stuff you teach or you don't. If you do, then it's time for a change. And what I want you to do is get off the interstate right now, find a bank, change that $100 in your pocket into a $100 bill, and at the workshop tonight, give it away. And I said, I beg your pardon. And I got off the interstate, I went to a bank, got a $100 bill, went to the workshop, did a piece of the workshop, and then did a process where I invited everybody to decide how much they were willing to give away. We talked about the idea of the law of return. You know, how much are you willing 10 times, 1,000 times? Yay, 1,000 return. Everybody gets excited. Sure, I want 1,000 return. Well, how much do you want? Oh, I want $1,000,000. Okay, then get the $1,000 out of your pocket and give it away. Oh, well, wait a minute now. Let's not go quite that far. I mean, yeah, faith is good, but let's be sensible about it. Okay, then how much are you willing to give away? And so I had people take out of their pocket whatever it was. Myself and one other person gave away a $100 bill. And what I did is I had people wrap the $100 or whatever they were going to give away up in their hands and just start to walk. Got everybody out of their seats, had them walk around the room, and I had them do, on a signal, an exchange. So they'd receive whatever the person that they were facing had in their hand and give them what was in the other. And then they'd walk around the room for another 30 or 40 seconds, and I'd say, change. And they'd hand, without looking at it, they'd hand whatever was in their hand and receive from the other person. And we did that maybe a dozen times. Now, I go back to Fort Lauderdale, that's 18 years ago, I go back to Fort Lauderdale, and I still hear about that exercise. It brought so much up for people. There were two people that gave away a $100 bill. You want to see people who are feeling guilt. The two people who got the $100 bills tried to force us to take them back. Well, this was just an exercise. We don't really keep this, right? No, no. The idea was to give away whatever you gave away, and that's what you got. Well, yeah, but I can't keep this. I've got, no. I mean, it was really pretty interesting. And I remember with clarity, I got back a $20 bill, and it was like, okay, I said I'd trust it, and I'm going to trust it. Well, I went back, drove back up to North Palm Beach. The next morning, we loaded the car, got the kids in the car, said our goodbyes. People say, oh, Michael, you've just gotten things started here. You can't leave. No, we've got to go. I get in the car, and for the first time in about 60,000 miles, I turn the key in the ignition, and absolutely nothing happens. Not even a click, not a whisper. The car is totally dead. It's like, okay, I'll listen. We unpacked the car, and we stayed. That week, the phone started to ring, and I had a practice there where in that week I made about 3 times what I had ever earned in any week from the day I started doing this work, which had been about 7 years by that point. And it's never dropped below that since. I know exactly the minute where I shifted my mind energy about abundance. And I invite you to consider where your mind energy is about your creative process. The same thing applies in the area of health. You know, I hear the person who says, well, Michael, I've been praying for health twice a day for 20 years. Oh, really? Well, let's look at your process. Tell me about it. Well, 10 minutes in the morning, 10 minutes at night. Okay, what do you do with the 2350 that's left over? Well, you know, I spent a lot of time in the doctor's office. You know, I had this set of symptoms, and they didn't know what it was, and I went to the doctor, and they couldn't figure it out, and we worked on it. And, you know, just last week they figured out it was the ABC disease. I said, oh, really? Yeah. Then what did you do? Well, you know, I went home and I got out the encyclopedia and I looked it up. And you know, there were two or three symptoms I didn't have, but I've got them now. Oh, and then what did you do? Well, of course, I had to call my mother and let her know that they found out that I had the ABC disease. And I called my sister and my aunt and my uncle. And that night I went to an organ recital. You know what an organ recital is? That's where a bunch of people get together to talk about who's had the most organs removed, who's had having the next organ removed. And you watch people when they do these organ recitals, and you can see where their mind energy and their identity is. How many people have you seen doing an organ recital, or maybe you've done it yourself? Have you ever done this? Yes, and they found out what it was, and it was the worst one the doctor had ever seen. Like it's their identity. Well, you can tell where that person's prayer is, where that person's mind energy is. Is it any wonder they never step into health? Folks, if we want to create abundance in the arena of health, we need know absolutely nothing about disease. Specialists die of their specialty. Heart specialists die of heart disease. Cancer specialists, a statistically significant number, die of cancer. We don't need to know anything about the cause of disease. We are creative beings. You know, they've identified a thing in the schools where they study disease processes, schools of psychology. They study abnormal psychology, medical schools and such. And they've identified what they call the second-year syndrome. And the second-year syndrome is what they've come to identify when students are studying a set of symptoms or diseases, and by the second year, they're all, or many people, are expressing the very diseases they've been studying. Now, you'd think somebody would catch on that this has got something to do with the mind energy they're engaging in, that this is our creative process. And where you focus your mind is where your process will go. Focusing is a creative act. And it doesn't matter whether you focus on it because you love it or because you hate it. If your focus is there, the master said it very clearly, let thine eye be single and thy body will be filled with light. Focus on one energy to the exclusion of all else and you will produce that very result in your life. And as you recognize that process, you have the opportunity to undo, to remove. And in the ancient Aramaic language, the word forgive is the word that describes the undoing of the energies that do not belong within our system. Forgiveness isn't about letting others off the hook for what they've done to us. Forgiveness is about you and I owning our creative process and removing the energies from our system that do not belong there. And in the next hour, we'll look at an exercise for how to do that.